It is December 29th, 2012. This is Geek Speak on KUSP. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on the show, we'll talk about geek news of the week, what we found interesting. I think we actually might cover some stuff throughout the year and maybe a little bit of predictions coming this next year. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. Miles is a programmer and political, activist?
Chunky.
And currently you work for a software development firm as a programmer full-time.
Yes.
And I...
good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for being here. I'll let you jump into your first news story, sir.
Let's take a look at ion drives. Ion thrusters, I should say.
Ah, yes. Space travel. Yeah.
Yes. The principle behind an ion drive is that you have a relatively small amount of fuel, and you send out that fuel, so you have a very small amount of thrust. So you're not getting a 0 to 60 anytime soon.
Right.
But the thing is that it keeps accelerating. So if you're in space and you don't have that large amount of drag that we have here on Earth of wind and the like, you're going to get faster and faster and faster and faster. And this is the way we're going to get... This is the way it's theorized we're going to get...
To another solar system.
Yeah, to another solar system, or just to get to other places much faster, to get to Titan, for example.
And one of the reasons for this, of course, is that your propellant is ions, and therefore you can generate them as you travel. You don't have to carry a whole bunch of fuel.
Right. Well, you do have to carry fuel, but the fuel ends up being much more compact, right. Much more efficiently used. And in this case, NASA is using, with their next engine, NASA's evolutionary xenon thruster, xenon. Xenon is really wonderful in that it's, even though it's a rare earth element, it is non-combustible. It's a noble gas, and it compresses very well. So in liquid form, you have a very small space, but a very large amount of fuel. Relatively so.
Yes.
And the big news now is that they have set a new world record for continuous operation for an ion drive. And this is 43,000 hours of continuous operation.
Whoa. They've been running for a while. I guess you do have to test these things. And is this on Earth?
Yes. And this is the equivalent of... 5 years of operation. And the reason why this is important is because it has such a low thrust ratio and an instantaneous scale that you need to have it running for a long period of time and make sure that you can test it out, that it will work for that long period of time without failing. Otherwise, you're just going relatively slowly and stuck at that relatively right, slow speed. Right. And also, a side thing about xenon, another great thing about it is it works as an effective heat sink. So as you're spitting out the xenon, you're actually being able to eject a lot of that heat, excess heat.
Right.
Which is a major problem in space because you can't vent that heat out very easily. You don't have any air around you in order to conduct to... There's no convection. Once again, there's no air.
How do they... I guess they do black heat radiation.
Yes, you can radiate heat, yeah. Although that's not very efficient in space.
Not like our systems where we have air blowing across fins here on Earth for air cooling. So the Voyager 1, last week I covered some interesting stories from the year, left our solar system this last year. Mm-hmm. And its propulsion system was spent very quickly, right? Basically, we sent the Voyager system, their throne, if you will, and then their velocity, I would assume, slowly decreases, not very much.
But propellant on them to get them to that orbital speed,
right,
and then slingshot them around a couple of different planets, like slingshot around Jupiter.
But their base velocity doesn't increase except for by the slingshot methods of these other planets. So once it's past one of the largest planets, I mean, the last planet it does that to, it no longer increases in speed.
In fact, it decreases because
slightly, of
thermal differential.
Right. So eventually it will slow down, or it might get picked up by another solar system or something. But the point is that it's kind of, we're talking eventual, we're talking long periods of time. Like it doesn't really leave our solar system in an effective way at all. But right. with a propulsion
it's
system,
how many light hours away now?
I can't recall what the distance is. It's pretty awesome. But this a system that uses an ion thruster, it will continually to accelerate. Mm-hmm. And though that doesn't seem exciting for the first 10 years or so, eventually it gets really fast.
Right. Or even in 5 years.
Yeah.
You're still talking about, even if you get to 1/10 the speed of light.
That's pretty impressive.
That's really fast.
Yes, it is.
Because we are not there yet.
Yeah.
We're not even close.
All right. Well, cool. Thank you very much for that story about ion propulsion systems. I wanted to mention a little gaming trends of 2012. We don't cover gaming on Geekspeak as much as we did when we first started doing Geekspeak, because you and I just don't game as much, I would assume.
No, I don't.
Yeah, I think the whole...
Aside from the lack of time, there's also the disdain for my partner for
gaming.
For video gaming.
Yeah, same here to some degree. My kids game a lot, probably too much. But I follow a person, Dean Takahashi, who works for VentureBeat. Actually, he's been on the show a couple times over the years. And he's got this great... He does a few things at the end of the year, which is a lot of fun. One is the wrap-up of the year. One is predictions. And he also talked about his ratings for his predictions from last year. And one of the things I was reading these articles, I realized that I don't know if we've ever really we've really talked about the term gamification. And I just thought I'd throw it out there, Miles. Do you understand that idea, gamification? You know,
yeah, I thought we had, actually.
Have we covered
that idea of you have some task or some behavior that needs to be changed or improved, and so you turn it into a game, and that engages the human mind into a more focused endeavor.
Right. It uses the things that are compelling about games, especially computer games, but in games in general, for the human psyche, that part that we like, seem to like games. And it uses that idea in other spaces other than games.
Right.
So a very good, a common idea.
It applies dopamine to work.
Yes. Dopamine to ridiculousness. But so I have been seeing it a lot happen in the last couple years. And the Dean's article does mention that gamification was pumped up in 2012. It increased, it emerged, it became a more common thing to see. And you'll see this all over the place. But one of the things you'll see is badges on people's websites, or in general, this idea that you've got some kind of token that you've succeeded at something. And there's a great TED Talk I'll have to find that's about the idea of a future world where everything's gamified and what that would look like, you know.
Right. And if you really think about it, Facebook is gamification. That like button, and can I get a whole bunch of likes for this post that I'm putting
in? Yeah, if you're motivated in that way, it is. Yeah, definitely. And I think it's also... It's telling that even that like button's so easy to do. It's very much like a game. You don't have to write a comment to make some thought about it. You can just go, yeah, like it. So that feeling, I agree. And I've seen gamification ideas used effectively in different spaces. Education is one of them, which is a lot of fun. There's this website called Code School, which I believe I've mentioned on Geekspeak before. And we're gonna have them on in the month of January about their system for teaching people how to code. It is very gamed. It's like a game. You learn a whole lesson playing this kind of task. I've gone through one or two of the tutorials. I think it's kind of cool. It probably would really work for maybe a younger set that enjoys games more. I got to say, I would rather, to some degree, just read a book and try some code to learn how to program, right? So being led through this very structured format is a little bit too much railroading for me on learning.
Something I find funny is that more and more, because I do a lot of UI or front-end development,
yeah.
A lot of the same skills that apply to performance on the UI also apply to game engines and how they work. And
yeah.
I find myself moving more and more into this realm of how do I make a game out of it, or how do I do this, because the skill also applies.
Can you give an example?
I think of things like, how do you make an animation more smooth?
Mm-hmm.
And using the APIs that are available there, and also figuring out, okay, what is the most optimum refresh rate for the human eye on an LCD screen?
Right. So you're saying is as the interface that you're building on a website and web application, whatever, gets better and better or more enhanced, the tool, the thing that you're looking for as a model of what can happen is in the game space.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting because, of course, we've for a long time, we talked a lot for years about graphics cards. And we're always talking about the graphics card as the pinnacle of processing power, all these different qualities the graphics card has. But of course, the reason why they're being made and sold was because of games. Right? The games definitely pushed that envelope of technology.
Yeah, and still to this day, the numerical community that is trying using supercomputers from GPUs is very much piggybacking on top of games. It's not the other way around. It's not like they are actually driving the market. It's games still drive that market, and making it a commodity item is making it easier for people making supercomputers.
Right. So companies came out. Dean mentioned gamification services from Badgeville is a company, scored $25 million in funding as its business took off. So there's a lot of money to be thrown into that gamification space. So if you start seeing in the world on websites, on any space where it seems like you can get rewarded by having a badge, or that as you do something, you get some kind of ranking, notice that that's a tool that's used that's taking advantage of your like for games. And just be aware of it. I think that as we have this more interactive marketing engine that attacks us in every way, we should be aware how it manipulates our psyche.
Right. And also, when I talked about an animosity or disdain for games coming from my partner, this isn't necessarily to say that she believes that games cause people to become violent or anything like that. It's more along the lines of, but there are so many things that we need to get done.
games seem to solve any. Right?
Yeah, don't get anything done. All they
so,
do is waste
you know
time.
What she should do is look at using gamification to help you with chores around the house. Right? So you get a little, I mean, we do this kid rearing. Yeah. I remember early on trying to get my kids to use the bathroom more by themselves. There's a very common tactic. You just put a star on a chart every time they go to the bathroom by themselves.
Isn't it amazing how much kids love stickers?
Yeah, yeah. And that's gamification, right?
Yes.
The thing about gamification that's the most noticeable to my mind is that I can't stand the term gamification. It's insulting to my understanding of language. But then again, I hated the term blog when it came about too.
So you have, and now you have a problem with neologisms.
Yes, okay. I do. I actually do. And I think it's it tries to wrap up something in a kind of clever way. It's insulting to some degree. At the same time, that's how words emerge, right?
Some point, I was actually thinking, what would be your alternate term for gamification?
I don't have one. It perfectly fits what we're talking about, right?
The one
playification?
I have a big problem with is a programming term that is used over and over again, automagically.
Oh, gosh. We've talked about this on the YouTube before.
Yeah, I cannot stand it. People are like, well, it's like magic. No, it's not. You can look at the code. Like, you know it's automatically happening for you.
Yeah,
we have a word for
there's
that.
There's nothing, right. There's nothing different about it besides automatic, right? So that's that idea that, I don't understand how it works. It just happens. And you'll see that in marketing people. They'll go, oh, well, this just automatically happens for you.
Or it's a magical device.
It's a magical. Oh, man. So irritating. For our skeptical kind of brain, that's just an insult to programmers everywhere. All right. Your next story, sir, there's a little bit about gamification.
I have some bad news, some sad news.
I can tell by your quality of acting that it's not actually, but go on.
Well, it is. It's a piece of history that is being consigned to the dustbin. The 386, the Intel 386. Oh, such a wonderful system back in the day. The first fully 32-bit Intel processor. It was the processor that Linux first was made for, written for.
You know, the 386 machine, the processor, was the first computer that I owned by myself. The computers before that were family computers. That was the first time I owned my own computer, 386.
And it is now being removed. Support for it is being removed from the Linux kernel.
By the death of it. I was like, Intel's not making them anymore, is it? Are they? They might be.
The very first processor made for the Linux kernel, or rather, the Linux kernel was made for that processor and then branched out after the fact, is now being removed from its support line.
Now, so that means that you won't be able to run Linux on a 386, the newer builds of Linux.
Right.
And that's the kernel level, so all distributions of Linux. eventually won't have this. That's pretty sad, I guess. Is that sad? I think it's interesting that our technology, our hardware and software compatibilities slide along this very flexible scale, right? Like, now the kernel, of course, can run on so many different processors. It's insane, right?
We hear now, bear in mind,
we don't even cover the stories anymore about how many processors it actually runs on. But
now, bear in mind, this is 22 years later.
Wow.
1991 was when the first Linux kernel was released, and that was for the Intel 386.
Now, the Unix kernels that exist, BSD, FreeBSD, there's other kernels around that are Unix-based and not Linux. How many are there, and are they supporting older processors? And do you know?
Supporting older processors is one thing. Like, for example, Linux has recently put back into the core, or for regular builds, the M68000 series, which is the Motorola, the type that Apple computers were based on before PowerPC processors.
Yeah.
And before Intel processors for the Macs. And so that's still around. And especially distributions like NetBSD will have a lot out there. But as far as I'm aware, Linux is the operating system that has the largest number of different platforms that it supports. It surpassed NetBSD a little while ago. So still, it's sad to see that little bit of history. I'm not really sad to see the 386 go.
No.
There's
worse things in the world.
My iPhone has a better processor than a 386. But both in speed and in power usage and basically in
every
amount of memory that it can handle.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's still a little bit of sadness to go. At the same time, Linus Torvalds, the person who most responsible for the Linux kernel and who wrote the original Linux kernel, says, yeah, I'm not sentimental. Good riddance.
Yeah, but he's kind of like that about everything.
Yeah, he is.
All right, well, I've got a geek bit that I'll tell in the beginning, until the middle of the show. So you go ahead and next story, sir.
For those who are wondering whether or not global climate change is actually happening, I'm sure all of us out there knows at least a couple people who are skeptics, global climate skeptics, if not, or deniers, I would use the more pejorative term myself. Or you may be one yourself. Well, let's put this little bit in there. Aside from the IPCC report that's a draft was recently released saying, we're even more on board than we were before. Come on, folks, get on, let's be clear about this. There's also another industry that is not related directly to climate science that has come out full bore for climate change, looking very closely at it, and that is the insurance industry. The insurance industry is not known for their flights of fancy, for their, this might happen, so let's do this. Oh, this might happen. No, they're very, very conservative, and I mean that in the traditional term for conservatism, way of looking at the world and whether or not things can be changed. And they are very much looking at how global climate change can drastically cut into their profits. If the severity of storms is going to hit harder, or droughts are harder, or floods become more severe, they need to fit that into their actuary models. And they are.
Makes sense. They should. So are they seeing a increase in rates to the consumer because of global warming, effectively?
Well, I don't know if they're seeing they are looking at changing their rates. But they were seeing things like Hurricane Sandy doing $80 billion worth of damage to New York and New Jersey.
Now, is Hurricane Sandy due to climate change? Do we know?
No, but an individual storm you cannot apply to being a particular thing. However, you can look at a trend of storms and say the severity is getting more
intense. And that's, of course, what insurance companies base their business off
of. And they're happening at higher latitudes,
right?
For example. And so seeing things like this at in New York and New Jersey at that latitude and that severity, and you're starting to see more and more years where was the top 10 years in terms of temperature have all occurred in the last 15 years, something like that, some ridiculous stat like that.
Yeah.
where it's really getting harder and harder to ignore. Because we do know the cycle of warm water makes hurricanes more likely and makes their severity more intense. So that's just another little piece of that puzzle that's actually found in a paper in Science Magazine.
All right. One of the stories I want to cover, 13 must-see stargazing events of 2013. 2012, we had some really impressive things happen skyways, and there are going to be some interesting things happening in 2013. One I want to suggest is that a partial lunar eclipse will occur, but it will not be available in North America. And the time to travel, if you want to see this kind of thing, to Europe, Africa, Australia, and most of Asia would be April 25th. So think about your plans. You want to head out to Africa to see the lunar eclipse during the 25th of April. Miles, at the end of last year, we did a little bit of, we talked about what we'd want to accomplish in the following year. One of the things you mentioned, it's been a year of this, is that you wanted to teach somebody something new about math every week of the year. And if you did not run into somebody during, I think it was every week, it wasn't every day, was it?
I think it was every week.
Yeah, it was conceptual. I mean, functional. And you said that you would try to do that the entire year. And in weeks where you didn't actually teach somebody else, you'd learn something new for yourself, which of course. How'd you do with math this year?
Well, teaching myself, I think I've learned quite a bit. I went back through and brushed up on linear algebra and got that working for matrix manipulations on web pages. By the way, it's a fascinating theme in there, and it's really not that difficult.
Yeah. Well, that, what I think is wonderful is that you did that because of work, because of the work you actually do as a programmer. Yeah.
Working on some polyfills. Yeah.
Yeah. What's a polyfill?
Polyfill is making an older browser act like a newer browser.
And how does matrix math help you on that?
Because newer browsers will support things like rotation, translation, XY translation, skewing. In other words, making the top at a different level than the bottom.
What we're talking about is manipulating images on a web page. It used to be that if you wanted an image to look slightly different, you'd open up Photoshop, rework it, and put the file back up. With both CSS3, the newest version of cascading style sheets, which is part of the web standards, there's actually a whole bunch of stuff built into the language where you can skew it, you can rotate it, you can do things that...
And scale, yeah.
Scale, which are very convenient for, building web applications.
Well, yeah, it makes things more interactive. Things like if you put your mouse over a button for the button to get a little bit larger.
Right. It used to be that that'd be different. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure you'd be used to it looking at the Apple dock at the bottom where you mouse over and the icons would get larger as you moved across it.
So that's supported in CSS3. So you said polyfill is about making older browsers. How does that connect?
When I say older browsers, I really mean Internet Explorer. because it's basically the only family of browsers that didn't support it. And that was before Internet Explorer 9. So Internet Explorer 8, 7, and 6 are really the targets here. And they have all supported matrix manipulation. People have tried to find little ways of rotating things by 90 degrees, but that usually isn't very useful just to do, because that was just for things like Chinese scripts, you know, looking from top down,
right,
reading from top down, right to left. And but there is a filter known as a matrix filter.
In Internet Explorer.
In Internet Explorer that works off of a 2D matrix, but there you need linear algebra. And learning how that works and how it applies to pixel-based rendering.
So you could do a rotation, but in using matrix math to do the rotation.
Right, because rotation, scaling, translations...
It's all about moving the pixels around a bit.
Well, they all have specific matrix transforms. In other words, you have a two-dimensional matrix that have certain values.
We're talking about a grid with a whole bunch of dots in it, right? And so you could say,
a grid with a whole bunch of numerical values.
Yeah, sorry. I'm trying to talk about a bitmap image on what an image actually is on the web is actually a whole bunch of color points.
Right, but what I'm talking about with regard to this linear algebra is not, pixel values. It's talking about numerical values within a two-dimensional matrix, and there's a certain process for multiplying different matrices together. And at the end of it, you come out with these values that you can apply to... an input XY value for a pixel, you multiply it by these matrices and you get back an output where is the new location.
Okay.
And that new location, if you put in, for example,
if you do all the pixels,
cosine X for, the cosine x, negative cosine x, and different values in that matrix, you end up with a rotation by 90 degrees.
Right, right. Okay. So in trying to do these polyfills, you want to need to figure out this matrix math a bit. And you're doing, of course, this in all in. Is it JavaScript or VBScript when you go into Explorer? Okay. Cool.
I could do it in VBScript, but why?
But why would you? Why would you put yourself through that pain? I was interviewing this last month at companies to do coding, and they were talking about my history in programming. I was like, well, I used to do UI design in Internet Explorer using VBScript. And I just kind of shovered it myself. Like, yeah. So that's, when you hired me, that's what I was doing.
Right, and then there's stuff like hue, saturation, lightness, values to RGB, doing that conversion. Stuff like that. So I've
other math that you see.
By doing polyfills, it's amazing how much math you do and have to learn how to do.
Yeah. Well, cool. Thank you. And do you want to wait a week before you figure out what you want to be doing next year? Or do you have an idea?
I think I will wait a week. I haven't quite decided.
We'll talk
about
that
next year.
I think in
general, my things are not geeky. They're more like be nicer to people.
Yeah, good luck with that. So, you're a pretty nice guy. Come on. This is KOSP 889 and KOSP.org. You can follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. I want to welcome people to call in now. We are opening the lines up with any questions about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. And I'll give out that number again. But first, in the air with me is Miles Elam. He's a programmer and a little bit of a political junkie. My name's Lyle Troxell. I'm a dabbler in programming and other things. I want to mention my first geek bit. Miles, I'm not sure if you've got one, but I've got one that's kind of fun. It's a video about a small train in Thailand going through a market. So basically, you've gone to open air markets, right? The markets that we have in town where you get the fresh vegetables, of course, farmers markets, right? A whole bunch of canopies normally, especially in a place where a lot of rain happens, you need to have a canopy and you have all these tables out and food out. And so in this little market, there happens to be a railroad track in the center of it. And this is a very dense market. So the canopies actually go over the railroad. The food gets put out over the railroad tracks. But four times a day, a train goes through about 15 miles an hour. So the horn blares and the entire market clears the street and everybody stands by where this massive train goes through the center of it. Anyway, the video is going to be up on geekspeak.org in just a little bit. Got a geek bit?
Yes, I do. Hagfish.
Of course. What?
It's an interesting animal. It doesn't have any visible eyes. You can see it has these long whiskers. And if you make it mad, it turns all the surrounding seawater around it into something of the consistency of snot.
Yeah, wet snot. Right, okay. Yeah. As a defense mechanism.
Yes.
Not just for fun.
Right. If something tries to eat it, it turns the water around it into like snot and anything that...
Sliminess. Can you say sliminess instead?
Sure.
Okay, thanks.
And you put in, something has it in their mouth and goes, ugh, I don't want that. And
same defense mechanism as a banana slug.
And the thing about it, though, and I'm going to put up a video of what happens when you put a hagfish into a bucket of water. Because, I mean, it's a non-trivial amount here. This is like you look at the size of the hagfish and the amount of water that gets transformed.
Yeah.
Is amazing.
Does it leave when it does it, or can it be okay in its own slime?
Oh, it just sticks around.
It just hangs out.
And that's one of the points, is that it all the slime erupts around it.
All right. And you can see this video at geekspeak.org by the end of the show.
But the thing about it that's interesting is that they're going to be using this to make different materials. They're using it for material science now.
Cool.
Because there are these filaments. It's similar to bone or nails. It's a protein, a filament, protein filament. And it's 100 times smaller than a human hair.
Okay.
And so it just attracts the water. And it smells like dirty seawater.
Mm-hmm.
And so
this, what it does, it ejects this stuff out into the water. And the water gets kind of attracted to it.
Everything just kind of congeals around it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if you pick it up, water will actually drip out of it, and you end up with
a more solid amount.
You end up with this more of that filament that you can work with. And it's a lot easier to farm than, say, spider silk or silk from a silkworm.
But it's very similar substance.
Well, it's a protonoid substance, so right. Yeah. So it's something that you could use to weave or put into a mat or something
cool.
like that. And so it may be another realm of cheap, abundant fiber.
Yeah, cool. Thanks. Awesome. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. We can answer your questions about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like, and I do mean anything about technology. Or about raising chickens, or you got turkeys, right? I don't know.
Yep.
We can talk, so give us a call if you'd like to ask us questions. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. And I'll give you that information again in just a second. I want to mention that throughout the year, we did a lot of talking about social media, about Facebook, about Twitter, about things of that nature, about privacy issues and concerns. And in the drive-in this morning, I was thinking, Miles, that one of the things that's so apparent to me in my life now is that the Facebook application, the space of the Facebook, is actually kind of important. I do a lot of work in there. And the settings are complicated. And over time, I've gone and modified things the way I want them so that they're not irritating me. I turn off email notifications of almost everything. The way I did that, though, was not through Facebook. The way I did that was through filters in my email account. And mostly because when I get irritated in email, I'm normally in my email application. That's the time to set up my filters. You know, take all of my messages from this certain group that I'm kind of associated with and put it in the subfolder and remove it from my inbox and things of that nature. So recently I decided that Gmail actually has a really cool labs project, which is smart folders or something like that. I'll link to it on the GeekSpeak note page. And basically what that does is it tries to assume, oh, this message is through a mailing list, and so put it through your mailing list folder. So it kind of automagically – sorry, I couldn't help it – automatically filters your email for you, removing it from your inbox kind of conveniently.
So I hope you got coal in your stocking.
Yeah, I did for that, definitely. I will next year. So in the filters, I decided to try this out. I always try out new services. That's one of the things we do as geeks. We have to kind of learn about everything we can. And so I deleted all my preset filters that I've built over the years. Just wiped them out. I must have been tired or something because it was a bad idea. So now I get all the junk spam from all these companies that I'm participating in. And I have to say, my disdain for Facebook has increased tenfold. I really don't like the service. Janet wants you to learn about your birthday. You want to share your birthday with Janet? I'm like, I don't know who Janet is. Oh, is it that Janet? But also, it's an application. It's a side application that wants my birthday information. No, thank you.
Yeah.
And again, like every day, hundreds of them.
You know what also angers me?
Yeah.
It's not just the fact that someone will like a very spammy company.
Yeah.
It's the fact that for some reason, I went to high school with people that like McDonald's. what is – I don't understand this.
Oh, man. And then when the political stuff comes around, like gun control, the amount of people that I have that are not aligned with my thought process.
Well, see, I'm a political junkie, I like having a lot of different points of view come in. And
no, it's fine. It's kind of interesting. But it's also one of those things you're like, wow, I wouldn't actually have them at my house all the time. And yet they're in my face. Their perspective is in my face all the time on Facebook.
What I find interesting is that I have a friend on Facebook, someone I went to high school with, that was talking about how she absolutely doesn't want gun control because she loves firing her AR-15. This is not a joke, by the way. I mean, I have a friend who really loves her assault work.
It's just because you're in California. That seems strange. I mean, come on.
She lives in California as well. Okay. She's a California native. And it's funny the back and forth we've gone. We really disagree on that. But I really enjoy having someone who has a very different perspective than I do. And when we are face-to-face with one another, we get along great.
Yeah.
And we had a great conversation.
And you probably get along great through this dialogue, right? Because you like the type of people in your world that can argue with you their point.
Well, it's hard to tell. That's the thing. If you are in person, you have facial cues. You have different things to be – the nonverbal communication to allow you to know if you're pushing too hard or to let the other person know that you're being sarcastic or just trying to get their goat, but you're not really serious. And that subtlety is lost.
Yeah.
And so that does put a strain on online conversations.
This is why we see so much argument and intensity and trolling kind of effects in the online space. We don't have all those skills that we've accumulated over eons.
We also hang out with people that are just rude.
That's true. So I don't want to get included. I want to stop talking about gun control. We're not talking about that. Don't call in about that. I won't take the call. But what I do want to talk about is this idea that, I mean, you did bring up this really great idea that you're kind of person that likes to hear the other opinion, the other thought, the other idea, and to be inundated with that. We know that our social media structures and the web in general and the way media is delivered to us is getting smarter, and it likes and as a consumer or as somebody that's trying to sell stuff to you, the companies that are trying to do that want you to like being around them. And therefore, their impetus is to tailor their message around your desire. And of course, we're being tracked all the time by all these different sites. And therefore, you should get less and less information that counters your idea. And I think that Facebook's goal, of course, is to get you engaged as much as possible. So it's tempting for them, for their system, to actually feed you stuff that you could argue about, because then you'll spend more time looking at their ads.
Except that, from what I understand from research, people surround themselves with people they agree with.
Yes.
And people that they disagree with vehemently on something that is true and dear to their heart will unfriend someone.
Yes.
Or block them.
Yes.
Or things like that. And
so it's a tempting little space to play.
And I think that is a shame.
Yeah.
Because I have learned a great deal, one, in terms of individual points on various topics, from people who don't agree with me. Even if I don't change my overall outlook on a particular topic, I will learn some nuance to it and learn some, hopefully, some humility from learning from someone else what their point of view is. But it's also learning to see how someone else thinks. Because how do you engage with someone if you just take from the point of view of, oh, well, the person who disagrees with me is just stupid.
Right.
That doesn't help. It doesn't help the dialogue. It doesn't help another person come over to your side if all you do is think of their being ignorant.
Right. Like, well, so that would be one thing you would ask people to think about in this next year, is try to understand another person's perspective. Try to figure it out, especially if they diametrically opposed to what your current
right. Something that you
is.
Find just a horrendous point of view. Try
understand
to understand
yeah,
why someone who is not stupid
right.
would come around to that point of view.
So in my frustration with Facebook and getting all these spam, I realized what I need to do is go into the Facebook account settings and change all this stuff, because I know that I can turn off the settings that email me, all these things. You know, there's a lot to do in Facebook's application structure. But actually, it's a complicated application, and it would take me some time to step through it, and I can do it because that's what we do. You know, it's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. But I realized that actually, there's actually a space here for a service provider to modify and fix your Facebook account, right? So this idea, and I'm sure this exists, because once you have an idea in this world, you somebody else has already thought of it, right? You're actually never thinking of original things, I don't think, especially in this tech space with a lot of people thinking about it. But this idea that I could go and
also the really sad part, which is we are not unique snowflakes. We actually have very distinct patterns that are easily modelable.
But I could see spending, you know, $5 a month or something like that for some service provider to fix my privacy the way I actually like it, to kind of translate what my desires are into the Facebook settings and all the other settings. I could definitely see a service of that nature being convenient, because every time they change the infrastructure and the way things work, you get different settings. Kind of inherently. Anyway, just a thought. Let's go ahead and take a call if that's cool with you, Miles.
Absolutely.
Oh, good. I thought it might be. Well, Hal, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning. This is Hal.
Hi, Hal.
And I'm having a lot of trouble with my Gmail account. I use Thunderbird in my laptop, my main computer. And all of a sudden, I couldn't directly send messages I couldn't directly send messages. I can still download them into my basic main Gmail account.
Okay.
And I can't figure out why or how, and I'm thinking about deleting the account and then creating it again, but I'm worried about losing all my messages.
Sure.
Or,
okay, well let's help you through that. First off, let's just take some basic understandings of mail. There's three ways to get email and to send email through the web. There's actually two ways to send email and three ways to get email. Or through the internet. You can go to the website and use their web interface, which Gmail, of course, wants you to do, because they can deliver new advertising to you at that location.
Yeah,
and therefore,
no,
they
that one
revenue.
Still works.
Right. That one will work great, and that's their base business model, and that's the one they care about. Now, they're going to care about the other ones as well. The other two are the standards of mail protocol. It's called POP3 and IMAP.
No, I'm on IMAP.
Okay, good.
IMAP,
right off the bat, you're going to be in a lot better state. If you're using POP, what you're doing is you're copying the messages from the server and erasing them at the server at some level and keeping them locally. So your local copy is the only copy. IMAP... So you're using IMAP, Hal, which I think it's great. You're a long-term GeekSpeak listener. That's probably why you're using IMAP. I think I use IMAP as well for my native clients. And what this does is this basically is a syncing service built in to the mail protocol, where you get copies of the messages down to your machine. They never get erased from the server. As you change them locally, they get changed on the server. So it's kind of the original syncing concept, I think. that at least the first one I engaged with. So that's receiving mail. The sending actually works differently. It's SMTP. SMTP stands for what, Miles?
Symbol Mail Transport Protocol.
Cool. And it's been around. It's the earliest form of standard protocol that's still in existence, to my knowledge. It's an amazingly base-level structure of the web. It's why we have so much spam, but it's also why we have so much freedom in email. Wouldn't you agree, Miles?
Well, it is basic, but there's no – I mean – I don't know.
Okay.
That's a long conversation.
All right, let's not get into that. So, Hal, what's happening is the way your SMTP is set up, Google doesn't like anymore. Most likely this is a security setting. This is whether you're using SSL, whether you're using your email username and password. It was common for a while to allow – Gmail would accept mail from your email account, possibly through SSL or without SSL, with the password or without, and that somehow changed – so that it's no longer working, or Thunderbird's messed up. But let's go with the former. You want to go into your settings. You want to go to your Gmail account, log into Gmail, and go to the settings there and look at what the settings should be and follow their instructions. That's the best thing I can suggest for Gmail syncing with Thunderbird. They have really good tutorials on how to do it. Have you tried that?
Yeah, I've been through that several times with no success. So.
So it could be that you need to blow the account and recreate it. The lucky thing is that as long as all the mail that you're storing in your email client actually is on the IMAP server, you'll be okay.
Yeah.
And what I would recommend...
No, except it'll download it all 2 gigabytes of it.
Yes, it will be a mess. That's true. You might be able to cheat that download process. First, get an good internet connection. That's one way to deal with it. If you've got a laptop, you know, go to the university and go to the library there and use their Wi-Fi or something. It's very fast. But the other thing you could do is you could potentially cheat it and hack it, and that would be... take all the IMAP folder structure that's actually on your computer as cached directory structure that's kind of hidden to you and move that away from that location, then delete the account, then recreate the account, and when it starts to copy things over, copy those folders back over. Shut down the app and copy the folders back over. But doing all that could cause other problems, and it's more of an exploration of interest rather than getting the problem solved. The problem solved would probably be best to completely blow it away and restart it. But I wouldn't do that. What I would do next is get a different email client, a different free email client. Try to find one, download whatever. Try to set that up with your Gmail account and see if sending works. Because if it doesn't, you might have some other problem. That's a way of testing to see if it's something else. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you, Hal, for the call. You actually had a second question?
I do. I have a number of wireless devices that can connect wirelessly, phone, tablet, a couple of PCs, and all of them connect well and don't lose their connections to my wireless router except my main computer, which for whatever reason just every once in a while it gets bumped off or it loses the connection.
Yes, there's a few different it could be a hardware problem. Your main machine could actually have a heat problem with the antenna. There's a lot of things that play in that space. The Wi-Fi systems are extremely complicated. Is it not reattaching?
I'm sorry?
Is it not reconnecting?
No, it doesn't. I can manually reconnect it, but it doesn't automatically reconnect. And I had problems with my original wireless card. It's a Lenovo. They replaced it twice. They finally agreed to upgrade it to a 2x2. They replaced the antenna. You know, I mean, I'm just suspicious that I got a lemon.
Yeah. It's possible. It's possible it's not the Wi-Fi access point, but it's your computer. That sounds more likely.
Yeah. Well, that's what it sounds like to me. Is it possible that when the computer gets a little warmer, some of the connections are lost?
It's not even a connection. Yeah. It's not even a connection issue. It's actually thermal shutdown of processors. They're kind of designed to do this. If they overheat, they stop functioning. Electricity stops flowing through them, and they cool off. And so you'll see it's not an uncommon thing for technology to kind of have a boot cycle for itself, right? It'll shut down. You're like, oh, it should work again. And you wait and wait and wait, and then it starts working again. That's not an uncommon thing to do, to have happen. It's one of those cases where you'll see if someone says, well, I shut my computer down, it works, it shuts down, then it starts up, and about 2 hours later, about an hour and a half later, it stops functioning and it shuts down and doesn't work again until the next day. Well, it really doesn't work again until it cools off. And that's a common thing we'll see in technology, that it's got its own protection.
Yeah, well, I did have a fan failure in this computer. I had a motherboard replacement. I mean,
sounds like a mess. Hal, thanks for calling, and good luck on it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hal. If you'd like to call in with questions and comments about technology, please feel free to give us a call. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877.
And it's funny how you would bring up email as being this simple thing, and yet that answer was so complex.
Oh, it's complex.
It's just, from a protocol standpoint, email is extreme, well, can be extremely simple. It can be complex as well, but it's at its base level, it's extremely simple. And yet, our handling of email has become so fraught with peril.
Yeah. I mean, the reason, of course, why email's not as painful for us as it used to be in setting new accounts and such is that all the applications that we use, our iPhones, our computers, they actually do a whole bunch of automagical things for you. Sorry, Miles, I couldn't resist. when you set up a new email account, it says, what's your email address and what's your password? And what the system's actually doing is it going through a giant litany of how to figure out what all these settings are, the IMAP, the SMTP settings, whether it's using SSL or not. And it tries to go really secure using that information. It tries to determine what your user account is. And if it knows how the system is, like it's at gmail.com, it actually knows a lot of those settings because they've been saved into the application. So the protocol hasn't gotten any easier, but we're more obfuscated from the actual complexity now because our applications are doing the work for us because some programmer spent some time to do that work ahead of time. The thing that's interesting to me, Miles, is that we live in a society where though you and I have the ability to go set up and actually probably write a simple email client, we could probably do it, right? I've got enough books in my I have enough books in my office to do that kind of stuff, no problem. Even from scratch, from dead on, Java if we wanted to. It's so much easier to use a library that already exists. It's so much easier to then, let me just use a service that's already doing this for me, that you step away from the simplistic level to this more complex abstracted level where we stop paying attention to how the protocol actually works. Mm-hmm. You and I have both done a telnet session to see if SMT is up, right? I've never done a telnet session to see if SMTP is up with only SSL enabled because I don't think you can do that easily through without tunneling. Like it becomes a level of complication right away that though we have a base understanding of it, we're not really connected to how it works.
Like for example, I can send an email by connecting to telnet 425.
Yeah.
Like I know how to do that. I've known how to do that for years and worked for a company that was what they did for
sure.
A business. And at the same time, and we have had our own server, email server.
Sure.
We had a manager for years. And then we stopped.
Oh, it's so much better when we don't do it.
Yeah, because we just...
When you said we had our same server, my neck got tight.
Yeah.
My shoulder
even
started
those of us who know how this stuff works on a base level,
why would
don't
you ever
want to deal with it?
No. I remember the send mail. Send mail is like one of the classic mail systems that you run. And the send mail book is probably... 4 inches thick. It's a nightmare. And I remember when PostgreSQL became more common, it was a little smaller and it was a little easier.
You mean a PostFix?
PostFix, thank you. PostFix, another competitor, if you will, to SendMail. It's simpler and better and easier. And it's not simple, better, and easy. It's just a little bit easier than the other
application. Well, compared to SendMail, it is.
Oh, yeah, compared to SendMail.
Yeah, just for folks out there who aren't familiar with SendMail.
Count your blessings.
Not only is this book huge, I'm talking about a book that is...
4 inches.
Four inches. At the same time, send mail is so complex that people stopped writing its configuration file.
Yes.
You wrote a thing called M4 macros that you ran a program that would generate the configuration file.
Yeah.
That's how complex this thing was.
Wait, and the thing is, that's what we're doing now with ARM. We have applications that do our configuration for us, right? I mean... And as I mentioned earlier, the idea that Facebook gets to a level where I don't really want to go through all their steps and all their processes, I'd actually rather pay a service. I wouldn't mind having an application that did some of the things for me, right? I just know that because Facebook changes so quickly, you almost need a human kind of involved pretty tight to do the changes correctly.
Yeah. Now, I do have to say, for all you geeks out there and up-and-coming geeks, I highly recommend that you set up a mail server. I highly recommend it.
Oh, wait. Learn to program or set up a mail server? Because I think
they're
learning programs.
They're two completely different.
I know. Why do you want to cause people pain?
Because you can learn a great deal. Even if you don't want to have this as your general mail servers, just to have it so that you can have it up and running.
And I highly recommend that you don't listen to Miles' advice on this.
No. Because having done so, I, A, appreciate not having to administer it anymore, but B, I also have a better idea of when something goes wrong, what could possibly go wrong.
Yeah.
And learn how to, it's the same thing with programming. If you learn how to program, if a program breaks, you actually have a better understanding of what went wrong and how to fix it.
Sure.
But it's just something that, it's along the lines of, you should learn how to do your multiplication tables, and later on you may not care and just, you know, use a calculator. But you should learn that skill ahead of time, and it's worthwhile doing.
Yeah, and Miles,
and
I get,
I'm sorry,
I get how much you learn.
I found it fun.
I totally get that. I get how much you learn through setting up a mail server. But I think that there's probably other ways to learn some of those skills that doesn't just translate to how email works. I mean, because the other thing is that the way that Google processes your email and does all the work they do, that's not the same, right? I mean,
well, it's on a scale and a... And a complexity that is far beyond it. I'm talking about on a very basic level to see how it is done.
Right. Also, keeping in mind, I want to mention one thing about, since we talked about Gmail and IMAP and stuff. Gmail doesn't do the interface with IMAP, but the inherent way Gmail gets stored is not an IMAP server. So there's a translation layer. They have better features, different features than IMAP. And IMAP, the standard itself, is not necessarily increasing and getting better, which is kind of frustrating, I think. We're coming to the end of the show. This is GeekSpeak. You can learn more about the show and what we talk about every week up at geekspeak.org. By the time Miles and I leave the studio, we will have a whole bunch of notes and such about what we talked about today. GeekSpeak is supported by Planet Cruz Comedy, a comedy variety show with stand-up, sketch, and music comedy with the spirit of Santa Cruz. Saturday, January 12th at 7:30 p.m. at the Rio Theater. Tickets and more information at planetcruzcomedy.com. We are also supported by UC Santa Cruz, congratulating Professor Sandra Faber, recipient of the National Medal of Science, an honor bestowed by the President of the United States for her contributions to understanding the structure of the universe. More information is at ucse.edu. Full disclosure, I currently work at UCSE. Next week's show, I think we'll talk a little bit about predictions, and not necessarily predictions, but what we intend to do in the next upcoming year. What are those called again, Miles? I always forget the word.
Resolutions.
Thank you. And we also, during the year, during this next January, this month of January, we'll be having Code School on. They're a company that teaches people how to program using gamification. So that should be an interesting show. And some other topics as well we'll be covering throughout January. It's already being lined up, and I'll talk more about that in the upcoming week. For KUSP and for GeekSpeak, and, well, Miles, thank you very much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
And Rick Philman, who answered the phone. So thank you, Rick, for being here. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. My name is Lyle Troxell. Stay tuned next for Car Talk. And do keep in mind, if you'd like to follow us and such and like us on Facebook, please go to kusp.org. Or, and as well, I should say, geekspeak.org. For KUSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.